This episode of AVXL was recorded on August 24th, 2017. We're going to talk about a 4K Blu-ray player you might not want to buy, Roku taking the league, our favorite CD ripping software, and if we've jumped to 4K streaming already, and quite a bit more, ladies and gentlemen, including, brace yourselves, the 20th anniversary of Starship Troopers.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah. Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And I'm experimenting with noise-canceling in-ear headphones.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Something new from One More?
Something new from One More. $150, the dual-driver LTNG ANC in-ear headphones.
Sweet.
Just went up for pre-order. They go on sale in September. I'm going to be working on a review on those. And I will say, unlike my experiences in the past with over-ear headphones, noise-canceling headphones that make my skull want to collapse, these do not make my skull want to collapse or feel like it is collapsing, I should say.
A benefit of in-ear designs is that it can act more as an earplug, too. So it wouldn't necessarily need any kind of synthetic noise reduction. Which is great. Speaking of One More, I found my pair of triple drivers hidden in my closet. I was really thought I had left those somewhere in some other country. And so to say when I found that beautiful magnetically enclosed leatherette box, I did a little happy dance and I'm put those immediately right back in the backpack. Those are my go-to.
Oh, my goodness.
And actually, I got to say, I keep the original earbuds that came with my cell phone as well on hand, just as backup. Double backup, just in case, but cool. I am curious to see how these perform. And these are with the lightning adapter on them.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Well, beautiful if you're an Apple user.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
It's one of the interesting things about that's being debated right now, the next generation
or
Pixel
iPhone, iPad.
Phones, if they will be or will be lightning lacking. They will not be. I assure you, no Google or Samsung phones will be sporting a lightning jack in any known possible future.
Oh, I want to know how quickly I can get Android 8 on my S7 phone.
I mean Android O?
Yes,
but
bring that on.
It's an interesting because I've already Shannon was thinking about the next generation Pixel phone, but the rumor is that it's not going to have a headphone jack, and that's a deal breaker for her. We won't get into whether or not Bluetooth
it
audio
would,
quality is acceptable.
If I go down that route, I would have to pick a new. I'd have to get some new headphones because I currently all of mine are standard jack. So, yeah, I feel that pain. I saw that and the Essential Phone, and there's a lot of great designs out there.
Yeah.
I even saw a crazy-ass phone design that had a built-in VOC detector, organic compound, volatile organic compound sensing, military grade, probably to, like, hey, there's nerve agent in there nearby. Maybe you shouldn't
or
be here.
Diesel or, exhaust.
Or guess what? It's too late. Don't even bother running. Just sit down.
You're going to die in a horrible, miserable way. You should have
Three,
stayed home and
two,
watched movies.
One. Have you asked the Echo or the Dot to drop a bomb? Or it'll
Not
do
yet.
A, really? It'll do like a cool countdown?
No.
It can freak some members of the household out when they're... Anyway, it's.
I can't imagine why.
Exactly. I'm
so you
like,
can't be like, you know.
It's not going to.
Alexa, play.
Oh, you can do whatever you want, but.
You know.
Anyway.
Jerry Lee Lewis, play, John Coltrane. Play Coltrane's A Love Supreme. You got to be dropping bombs.
I notice you're now lacking your arm sling.
I am.
Did you survive the eclipse?
I survived the eclipse. The eclipse was extraordinary.
Wasn't it? Even in my hobbled view here in the Bay Area, all overcast and crap. It was really, you know?
We did a crazy...
I sat out in the backyard for at least an hour.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we watched the whole thing. We drove up to quite literally the middle of Oregon, for all intents and purposes.
Probably right in the line of
shadow. Oh, yeah. That was the whole point. We wanted to experience totality.
Optimal viewing.
Well, I had a friend who was always like, you know, the difference between 99% and 100% on an eclipse is the difference between something I won't say because this is a family-friendly podcast.
Yeah, it's the way to do it if you can.
I to the point point where we're already looking at like the 2019, 2021, and 2024 eclipses.
Was it Carbondale, Illinois? That's where I'll probably be on the next one.
Come on, Mom, we're going outside.
Going to Southern Illinois.
It's funny, you know what?
And I'm going to drift over the border into Indiana so I can get some illegal fireworks.
I know just the crew to go see that with down there. Maybe we can do a factory tour while we're there. This is technically a show about home theater and audio and portable audio.
Eye protection.
Inappropriate eye protection.
Noise-canceling earbuds.
You can't enjoy Blu-ray or UHD video if you've blown out the centers of your eyeballs by staring at the sun.
I was doing everything wrong, too. Oh, my God. I was pointing a 12x monocular at the sun because it was so overcast.
Can you even see out of that eyeball?
I put the solar filter in front of that, but still, that's focusing a lot of light energy.
If the solar filter is in front of the telescope or binocular, or you're fine.
Yeah.
Because it reduces a staggering amount
still,
of light.
I had a pretty hobbled last-minute setup, and I think I'm lucky just to be able to see.
As long as you had the solar filter, you're okay.
I got some good pictures.
Did I mention that this is a home theater podcast and we talk about audio a lot? Mike tweeted at AVXL, I thought I'd share with you, even though you've probably already seen it, and a link to a PC Mag article that talks about LG's UP970, which was announced earlier this year, I want to say at CES. And their hook was that this 4K UHD Blu-ray player was going to support both HDR10 and Dolby Vision as a standard. There are a few studios that have talked about doing Dolby Vision in Blu-rays.
And there are a handful out there now in UHD 4K format. So.
Which is awesome, right? Because the difference between HDR10, which is HDR, and Dolby Vision is, first of all, it's Dolby. And second of all, it's funny because I was like, you know, it's not dynamic HDR, so I'm not as excited. But
that's what Dolby Vision brings, is that ability to do a dynamic metadata that adjusts the luminance of the picture per scene or per frame even. And that provides just a taking better advantage of the available dynamic range on that encode.
Because with HDR10, you get one basically set of HDR mapping information
or whatever
for
the entire
2.5 hour movie.
That one value that was the best for the whole thing.
Right.
And in this case, I find in the brightest scenes and the darkest scenes are where Dolby Vision can shine. And having a player currently for the UP970 under 240 right now, for a player that supports both formats, Dolby Vision, HDR10, dual HDMI outputs. So if you need, if your AVR hasn't been fully upgraded yet to the latest in HDMI 2.0a support, you can then send off an HDMI 1.4 connection to that AVR for sending the audio there and the video to the TV directly. So it's one of those, I think at that price point, and granted that $240 is on a promotional deal.
Right.
Probably, I got to say, that's going to be the street price real soon.
It's for sale right now for $240. My concern, right, is you know, if you, it's getting brutal reviews on Amazon.
Oh.
Better reviews on Best Buy, but a lot of folks find it to be particularly noisy or buzzy. Varies with which disc you put inside of it. Like it might have balancing issues on the drive. The only apps are Netflix and YouTube, and my understanding is that that is it. There are no more streaming apps coming to this.
You know what? If that keeps the price lower, because
there's no DLNA on it, so you can't stream to it if you have a collection of movies or audio on a server.
That's less useful.
The ABS forum. You know, the AVS forum thread, I think, is, I would check it out before I bought one. There have been a lot of claims that it is particularly dark, especially on OLED TVs. So, you know, people are either like, this is great. I'm watching my Blu-rays.
Might need some firmware
4K.
Tweaks.
Yeah. Well, and there have been no firmware tweaks, as near as I can tell. So,
but I can't even think of one Blu-ray player or UHD Blu-ray player that I would go to first for doing streaming apps. It's just not an ideal platform. Generally way underpowered, or about as powered as older stick devices, but it's not the best way to have an app in your face. That's either where you want to go Roku land or if you have a game console, Xbox, PlayStation, those are the best in terms of just raw performance for running an app in 4K nowadays. Mm-hmm. So
if you've got the money, you know, the go-to is still, Oppo's like UDP 203.
Oh, for a Universal disc player.
Or universal disc player.
With support for both Dolby Vision and HDR10. And from a company that builds beautiful hardware. That's However, this is like half the price.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. So hopefully LG, I mean, it's frustrating that the noise issues may not bother you.
It's the last thing you want to. You shouldn't hear anything in your home theater, so hopefully.
Yeah.
Something to be aware of, though.
I would dig through. We got a link in the show notes to the AVS Forum.
Cool.
The official LG UP970 4K Blu-ray player owner's thread. As always, it is full of lots of things to consider before purchasing. If you're asking us what we want to stream video on, we're going to tell you a set-top box. Just ignore the stuff that's built into your television because it sucks in most cases. And if it doesn't suck now, it'll probably suck in a year when it hasn't been updated. Not to be brutal, but that's honest. TechCrunch has a nice article talking about Roku's. Roku's taking the lead, which is interesting to note. Sarah Perez wrote this one up at Sarah in Tampa on the Twitters. And Parks Associates... did an industry report that says 37% of streaming devices in the U.S. households or in U.S. households are Roku devices as of Q1 2017. 30% jump over last year, which is huge. Apple and Google, I think, are sitting in place or declining, and Amazon's Fire TV is kind of holding on to its install base is one of the things noted in the article.
Roku launched that whole new lineup that included a couple of premium streamers in addition to just super affordable options for 1080p streaming.
If you've got $29, you can have Roku plugged into your TV.
And then that and being the operating system and the back end for some of the most popular TVs now from TCL and others. They're doing everything right. And they're basically the interface that, and as long as they keep up that UI, that user interface experience that just surpasses either what you're getting built into your TV or just making it easy to add exactly the curate the content you want in a simple way from practically every streaming source available.
Yeah.
That's where the functionality and everything, it's like a perfect storm of goodness.
It's good stuff. I mean, it's funny. Roku says they have 15 million monthly users. eMarketer, which is another marketing studies company, they said, quote, 38.9 million U.S. consumers will use a Roku device at least once per month in 2017, which is like 23% of the connected TV users. And it's interesting. eMarketer counts individual users. Roku does their own internal active or registered accounts. Generally speaking, in a family, like in my house, there are multiple users for the device it's interesting. It's interesting to look at, right? Because a lot of people thought Roku was kind of an also-ran. Apple TV's falling, which might be why they're starting to play around with 4K or a 4K version.
I really do like the TVs with Roku built in because then even if you don't have cable or over the air, the experience of using like apps as channels is well done. I mean, it's just like you can set that thing up with just a wireless internet connection or a wired connection, doesn't matter. But you end up with a great viewing experience for a variety of content, no matter how you want it. At great prices, too. Generally, it's like it's funny that some of the most value 4K and even 1080p TVs out there are providing some of the very best user experiences. It's just very interesting to me. And I love to see that. And I love to see that company succeed too. Cause it helps. It helps me.
Yeah.
It helps other people. So
it's just generally not a bad thing when you have like three or four of the largest tech companies on the planet all trying to own a market and then being challenged and or beaten by a smaller independent company. I mean, this is good for
all
of us.
It's hard for those big companies to truly specialize and be masters of a specific thing. They can be generalists, but that's where small companies can always find that niche and survive and prosper and thrive. And more power to them, man.
Absolutely. We're talking about our favorite ripping application last week, and at Tim Jar tweets, what was the ripping software you both bought and loved? DVD Power Amp, DB Power Amp. I didn't quite catch it, but I want to buy it too. There are a couple places that play, or a couple companies that seem to play off of this name to emulate the original and the finest. You want to go to DB poweramp.com. Yep. We got a link in the show notes. I've been using it for years and years and years. Partially because it allowed me, one, it does flawless ripping and encoding. It rips and encodes pretty much any format you might ever want, and several I would not advise going to. It's got an excellent tool for finding album art, ID information. Accurate rip's really cool. It's basically, as a bunch of people rip a disc, it tracks the metadata for that and lets you know if you got the same results, i.e. if you have an accurate rip off the CD. And you might think like, well, the reality is a lot of your CDs may be a little more trash than you think they are. And your current ripping tool may be okay with that. It can guess. It can interpolate.
That function, too, can also tie into identifying what engineer did that specific, maybe a remastered disc. Because one thing, if you go back to the very original release of a CD, and then like a year later, if you bought it again, it may actually have a different, you know, hash associated with that rip now because it has been remastered or changed in some way. So I like that part of it just for almost the historical checking on a disc and what it's been through. Or if you've bought that same disc like three or four times throughout the years and to see it definitely is a different track. The other thing I appreciate too is just for multi-core CPUs, it'll take advantage of each core to do an encode. So if you're doing large batch encoding, it really can help tear through that in a way that I'm sure there are other apps out there that do that too, but man, that just does it.
It does it particularly well. I mean, I had a machine with I think at one point I had managed to, between the internal SATA ports and USB, I had 9 CD ripping drives going simultaneously.
And I use their tag editor too. When you install their software, it integrates you can right click on a file and edit the tag very easily and effectively and clearly. Yeah, it's just, you know, a little side effect, but something I appreciate as well.
There are worse things.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
So yeah, dbpoweramp.com.
Yeah. Company's called Illustrate that writes that software, and they've been writing it. So when you go to the DB PowerAmp website, you'll see the word Illustrate at the top. That's the company name. They've been doing it. I believe they created and managed that software since the beginning. So I think it's their baby. I am assuming.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
We got another tweet. Big on the Twitter this week at AVXL. Stefan tweets, have we jumped from streaming 1080p to 4K already? I thought no one was able to stream even 1080p. Is the compression allowing this? And yeah, and we've talked about this. The reason why both of us have giant stacks of Blu-rays and in Robert's case, a growing stack of UHD Blu-rays is because the bandwidth available on a disc vastly outstrips the bandwidth available for streaming, which means you might get, you know, 15 to 35 megabits per second devoted to, you know, every second of video on a disc, while you might be getting 1 to 15 megabits per second on a streaming connection.
UHD can, I mean, the data transfer rate on a UHD disc can exceed 100 megabit. So on the triple layer ones especially. So there is such a fire hose of data on a disc format compared to a streaming format. Typically, like you said, it maxes out at about 15 megabit. It's great if you have a connection that can sustain a 15 megabit link with everyone else in the household using your internet and it works flawlessly.
Right.
And that does, especially with newer compression technologies like H.265, that can do a very nice 4K presentation, including HDR and wide color gamut. I got to say, Amazon was probably some of the first content I looked at in that 4K beautiful streaming format. And it is eye-pleasing. And I've also noticed, too, that it kind of depends on the playback device as well.
Yeah.
And I want to say Matty Christian... MetaChristians also tweeted that if I buy a UHD movie on Google Play and stream it to a 4K TV, am I still getting the UHD quality? And it really depends on the playback device. Just to clarify that, it's like most of the apps built into 4K TVs or UHD TVs are 4K enabled. But if you're using an external box like a Chromecast or an older game console or something, you may be getting 1080p max. You may be getting something less than that. You may be getting 720p-ish It really kind of depends.
And it also depends on your internet connection, right?
So, totally.
You know, for Netflix, I think quotes 25 megabits per second to stream UHD titles.
That would probably look damn good, too.
Yeah, that should.
If you can, they can deliver 25 megabit with a 4K stream, HDR even. That's going to approach Blu-ray quality.
But, you know, you basically, you know, working backwards, you need a 4K Ultra HD TV. You've got to have HEVC or an HEVC decoder built into the TV. The TV's got to be like HDMI 2.0 and HDCP 2.2 compliant, which it should be if it's a 4K Ultra HD TV. Not all 4K Ultra HD TVs have an HEVC decoder. That's mostly going to apply to people who bought the very first round of 4K TVs.
Or sometimes the definition of what a TV is including the broadcast tuner or not. And that's where it gets a little mildly confusing on the Vizio side because they don't include the broadcast tuner, so they don't actually describe their TVs as TVs.
Yeah.
They are home theater displays.
Yeah, so, I would
That's a whole different side topic, but
I would also connect your TV via Ethernet if possible rather than wireless. Just to make sure you don't have any dropouts or issues.
That's one neat thing about the Chromecast Ultra, I will say. They put the Ethernet connection built into the power adapter, which is kind of clever in terms of that design, although it's a custom dongle. Don't ever lose that. Well, you shouldn't lose that anyway. You need that to run the damn thing. But
yeah. And you also, you know, for example, on Netflix, you need to have a plan that supports streaming in ultra-high definition. So.
Check.
Oh, my goodness. And that you have your streaming set up to the maximum rate possible. So there's a few things that go together to make this happen.
I mean, just one quick dirty example is with MLB TV, I find that it looks better on my 4K TV using a Chromecast Ultra than it does using my older PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
Now, I'm also doing some other weird things on my PS3 that may be affecting the picture quality with that similar app. But overall, I find that the 4K streaming boxes will deliver better picture quality overall, be it for the improved support for compression technologies or simply just having a little extra horsepower to one less thing to choke.
Right. Yeah, and you know to address UHD streaming on Google Play, like they specifically state, you need a consistent download speed of at least 15 megabits per second. If you're having issues with connectivity, they may stream to you in HD or SD quality. If your device or your television doesn't match their qualifications, they're going to stream it to you in regular 1080p HD or SD quality if things are particularly ugly. So it's worth... it's worth experimenting and playing around. And I'm pretty sure, if I'm not mistaken, that Google Play, is it only going to stream 4K to Chromecast Ultras?
No, it should be with anything that has, I would think, 4K support for Google's ecosystem. But that's a good, of course it's going to work with the Chromecast Ultra, but that's the easy one.
Oh my goodness.
But what other specific devices? Hey, one cool thing that came by was from, let's see, Don Engine? Donald W. on the Twitter. He pointed out that with a Raspberry Pi Zero, the whole product, with a Raspberry Pi, you can basically create something that has Chromecast-like features, Chromecast audio. And in this one in particular, the VoltaStream Zero is made for creating something like a Chromecast audio device.
Yeah.
To use it as a streamer. So
this is interesting, right? So, you know, you can take a chip, a $9 chip PC, you can take a Raspberry Pi Zero, you can take a Raspberry Pi, and you can add on the onboard audio on those is all pretty atrocious, right? So you can add on typically do what they call like a Pi hat, which is a board that clamps onto the pins on the Raspberry Pi and adds, in the case of this, I would be adding a better digital analog converter and like RCA jack outputs.
And in
the VoltaStream Zero, their idea was to create a Raspberry Pi Zero format, or basically, because Raspberry Pi is kind of open sourced, so they're taking a Pi Zero and they're adding in a better DAC. And so they're using a Texas Instruments PCM 5121,
oh.
which is, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's audiophiles out there that are going to be like, oh, that's not an audiophile DAC.
I don't know. Was that one of the chips we previewed at
CES?
It's
good. It's not. No, because you're thinking the stuff we looked at from TI at CES was primarily amplifiers.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And those were amazing.
Yeah.
The TI 5121 shows up in a lot of devices. Like audiophiles might be like, well, that's an acceptable DAC. But the reality is you know, for a lot of people, the TI 5121 is going to sound better than anything they've heard before. You know, whether or not you, you know, believe it is, you know, it's not as, it doesn't have, it isn't sprinkled with magic fairy dust, and it isn't one of the ones like, you know, people would be like, well, an ESS Saber DAC, while occasionally too clinical, is a, you know, more prestigious reproduction of the audio environment. I'm saying that just to mock people who love audio, including myself. But it's a good DAC. It's a quality DAC. A lot of how a DAC sounds depends on how it's implemented. You could take an expensive DAC and give it crappy power and do a poor job wiring it and end up with, you know, kind of compromised audio.
I mean, the Pi Zero is that the $10 version, like the most stripped down version of the Raspberry Pi platform you can get. And I like just at
this one,
see that they've taken that.
Well, they haven't.
Programmed it with the TI chipset.
Added. They've basically
added that.
They've taken a Pi Zero. They've added on the TI 5121. They've added the connections. But you're also talking about, you know, this is 4193 euros. So, you know, they've basically taken a really inexpensive.
They're marking it up a little bit.
It's $50.
Yes.
For
about maybe $20 in hardware.
Well,
but still, it's like I think that the way that should give everyone who's interested in those kind of platforms, though, it's like, hey, you know what?
Yeah,
I think about this. I think about Arduinos, and
my thought here is like I like that somebody built better audio into a Raspberry Pi Zero, right? Because it's an interesting device. It's not maybe the most practical one to build at home. Because it's designed to be embedded in stuff.
Considering you can get a Chromecast audio for less.
They've taken a five, and I think the TI 5121 might be what they use in the Chromecast audio. But, you know, they've taken a $5 or $10 computer. They've made it like, you know, $50. You got to order it from overseas. You know, and you could take a Raspberry Pi and just use a USB DAC or an external DAC or, you know, you could add on a board that does audio out. So I like this, but I'm not sure I'm ready to spend the money on it.
I think it is. It seems like it was one-offed or here's how it could be done. We're going to do a custom run. It's not going to be the cheapest it could be because we're not doing quantity here.
But you also as somebody who spent a lot of time with open source hardware in the last few years, stuff like this happens all the time. Like, and you know what I mean?
It's a Lego world.
Yeah. I want to think
one of my favorite people
nobody makes this thing. I'm going to design, engineer, and sell this thing.
It's just these kind of projects though really do kind of make me smile. There's whole armies of folks on YouTube in particular doing crazy cool things with electronics and coding literally in an almost plug and play environment. I mean, generalized programming,
right?
Plug and play on a breadboard just to get it, see how it will interact. And will this $5 part function? Will this $3 part function? And to be able to create cool things like that. I dig it. And granted, this I was thinking mostly that if you could simplify the power requirements, maybe it runs on less juice where you literally could, you could probably run this off a freaking battery for a party.
Well, but that's the whole point of the Pi Zero is to have an embedded device,
right.
An inexpensive platform to create. Like the first round of Pi Zeros, you know, people basically stuffed them into video game controllers.
Okay,
you know,
right.
And stuff like that.
Anyway, it struck me as kind of a cool project. And
it is a cool project.
Something I think, if you want to take the laser out, there's a company making the $50 version. If you want to do it yourself, you can probably do it for less than half. Plus your time.
Your time. And that's always where it gets interesting is how do you value your time? So, I don't know. It's I kind of, if you're talking about building a Volumio for example, a Volumio streaming box, and you don't want to add an pay for an external DAC, this starts to look really compelling for like $50. You are going to have to add on, a wireless USB dongle to the Volta Stream Zero. One of the things I like about the chip PC, which is the $9 PC, which does not have HDMI standard, but if you're creating an audio streaming box, you know, you can manually run Volumio on this $9 device, and then use the it's got onboard Wi-Fi, and you can stream. You could add an external DAC on that one.
That is pretty
and,
cool.
I was going to say Darko Audio. They've been experimenting with Rune, not the open source streaming app that Volumio is a fork from, but Rune, the sophisticated high end, I can stream my local FLAC files or I can stream from Tidal lossless, and they created. He's in love with the LS50, the self-powered LS50 speakers. So he started, he's just basically discovered the Raspberry Pi audio scene. And one of the things he did that I did not know you could do is you can embed the Rune, R-U-N-E software. In a Raspberry Pi. And then he realized you can actually create an iOS Rune endpoint with iPang running on a tablet. But it's cool. Like he's got a whole article on this, he calls it a 65-pound Rune endpoint for any USB DAC, which is cool. Cause then you can, you have to pay for Rune, but it's an extraordinarily nice experience. It's either like $500 for a lifetime license, or you can buy embedded devices. ELAC has a particularly nice one,
for something that where you're also adding in the visual interface as well. Mm-hmm. That's something where maybe
it's really nice.
That would cost you more to build yourself.
Well,
but
if you could build it yourself.
Yes, exactly.
It's funny because I run into so many people that are so offended by the idea of paying for software. And on one hand, I get it. But on the other hand, you've got this magnificent interface. Yeah, it's going to cost you $120 a year, or you can buy a lifetime, subscription for like $500, or you can do something like I mentioned ELAX. They've got the Discovery DS-S101G music server that will basically, you can throw a drive onto it, have all of your audio stream through that. It works as streaming Rune, and you get a lifetime subscription to, Rune Essentials. But I bring all this up. There's a lot of ways to skin this particular cat, and by going with something like the we'll put a link in the show notes to Digital Audio Review. I always think of it as Darko Audio, but it's DigitalAudioReview.net. You can build a very sophisticated audiophile grade streaming box for very very little money. So I will drop that into the show notes for everybody. Keith Foster, oh boy,
poor Keith. He moved.
He moved, and he reminds us to carefully pack and transport flat panel TVs because he sent a tweet, and there's a link, and it looks like somebody has taken a Scotchgard pad to a giant oval in the center of his TV.
I'm assuming it's an LCD, what I'm looking at, and it has a very very bright, completely almost white patch right in the center of the screen. 9 times out of 10, that's pressure was applied in the middle of the screen to where the layers compressed that normally have a very very well-defined gap between them.
I'm looking at this and I'm thinking somehow either they dropped it on somebody or somebody carried it. It wasn't hard packed and somebody carried it with their shoulder pressing in the middle of the screen.
Yes.
Or even more likely.
I didn't even think about that.
They laid it down flat in the back of the van and then they put another box on top of it, which then spend the next 75 miles bouncing up and down on the center of the screen. But generally speaking, if you can, put something... get the stiffest cardboard or board you can find, put it over the face, the screen side of your
You can
your
get
flat
moving
panel.
Boxes for TVs, and then that will at least encase it within the cardboard with some, shock prevention, but you don't want anything to ever press against the screen side. Know which side in the box that the screen is going to be facing.
And then
put that against the
wall
of the moving vehicle.
you know,
and
transport it yourself in the back seat of your
upright.
Car.
Oh,
transport it upright. If it'll, if you can.
You're not going to get a 65-inch screen, or it depends how big the TV is. Right. But yeah,
oh, I may have back. You know, the nice thing about having you know a bunch of family is you end up with cars with more vertical space in the back
seat.
The
tough thing too is I'm boxing up one of these curved screen TVs, and mm-hmm. there was a whole small book detailing how you're supposed to remove and insert the TV from the box. And in that case, they actually want you to lay the TV flat on the floor with the custom foam arch supporting that custom curved screen. And then it all slides into the box while it's still flat on the ground, which mm-hmm. goes kind of exactly opposite of what we just talked about. But,
oh, man.
But that's at least for boxing it up. And for my most prized TVs, I will hang on to that box for as long as possible,
yeah.
the original shipping container, if it was still in decent shape. Otherwise, every storage company I deal with or moving company will sell TV-optimized sized boxes, including pads and other things that go inside of it to help. But, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It's tough. When I first saw that, I'd normally associate that kind of a glare artifact with a strike. Usually somebody threw the remote at the TV and hit a small... It's usually a very small spot that's very bright. Brighter than the rest of the picture, and it doesn't change much. In this case, it's the whole middle of the TV. And apparently, Keith managed to get the moving company...
To pony up?
Yeah, a little bit. Well, he's working through that process now, and I'm glad he took the coverage on that, so
oh
to speak.
Goodness. That's awful.
Oh, man.
One last question before we go. Donald wants to mount a TV over the fireplace. And he tweets, I'm looking at installing a TV mount for a 65-inch television over a fireplace. How and what would you do? And I'm going to say, if you use the fireplace a lot in the winter, this might not be the best location, or the summer for that matter, if you're in Australia. Well, I guess that's their winter, but... You know, yes. Hemispheres are complicated.
If it's cold out,
and if you use your fireplace a lot, and you have the kind of fireplace that occasionally a little bit of smoke wafts up the front of the fireplace
oh.
up the wall of the house.
Yeah, hopefully that hasn't happened very often.
Yeah, if you know, I'm just
check your
saying.
Chimney.
Yeah, you know, fireplaces generate a lot of particles and they generate a lot of heat, neither of which is particularly good for your television over the long term.
If there's a mantle above the fireplace, that'll generally block, and
yeah.
even any kind of radiant energy that
right.
might somehow, it just wouldn't make it up there.
Yeah.
So it's good to know that the surface that you're about to put it on doesn't get unnaturally warmed
yeah.
by the wall behind it. It shouldn't be. This is all assuming you've got a properly installed fireplace.
Yes.
And
that you're not going to be like drilling. You don't want to drill into the brick of your fireplace to mount your television. You want to make sure you're not punching a hole through,
into the flue or something.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, as long as you're... Wood frame is always going to be the easiest to deal with.
Right.
And that the facade above the fireplace is actually fairly structural.
Yeah.
That it's not just facade. And they just, it was made to hang a picture frame on, but a 60-pound TV could be an issue.
You might find out a lot about the construction of your house and not in a good way. But yeah, assuming you've got,
most TVs don't weigh 60 pounds, though.
You know, so. 2x4,
that
you know,
is
and
the
you're not
easiest
like, don't
scenario.
Drill into the brick of your fireplace. Make sure there's not a flue liner in there. That
I'd
you
head
can
over
hit
to Costco and pick up. They usually sell Sanus stands,
yeah.
and I absolutely love them. And they usually have a articulated or just simple tilt or whatever.
Yeah.
Everything you need right in the box.
And you probably want tilt, even if you don't use it all the time.
Oh, you most definitely do above a fireplace.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you may not realize it, but staring above the fireplace is a lot like sitting in the front row of the movie theater. It can be incredibly uncomfortable.
At least a 10-foot viewing distance if you're looking at a screen above a fireplace. Otherwise, yeah, it's too much.
A recliner is another nice option when you're staring at a TV above a fireplace, because you're elevating the screen. It's probably going to be at least 5 feet off the ground.
And even so, even with the screen elevated, and even if you could recline back to look at it, you still want to angle that screen so it's as perpendicular to your viewing line as possible.
Right.
So, especially with LCDs, because the more off-axis you are, you will degrade image quality. So, yeah.
And having a box that can do some sort of slide playing show can be a really nice addition. I mean, because in terms of like what is affectionately known as the spousal acceptance factor, you know, a big giant black square or, well, I guess rectangle. See, hemispheres are hard and shapes are hard. Sitting above the television can be something less than feng shui for the room.
A couple of tips, too. If you can have an outlet installed behind that screen for that wall mount project. That will
so
go
you don't over. Have to run a cord down the mantle and around.
That's a big one. And then before they install the box, if you're going to have an outlet put behind a TV, put up. At least with Sanus mounts, they include a paper template that's the exact size. Stick that to the wall right where it would be mounted so you can make sure that the outlets aren't being blocked by the bracket that's going to be mounted on the wall. Otherwise, this is a very fairly simple DIY project with wood
frame
construction.
And you got to run the HDMI cable. Yeah, the TV mounts are easy. If you own a drill, if you can turn a Phillips or a straight slot screwdriver, you can hang a television
and
safely.
And the beauty of Sanus stands and others, I'm sure, they include, even if you get the bracket just right, perfectly level on the wall, and you finally hang the TV, it may be off left or right by a couple degrees. They all include custom little adjustment screws that just make it so you can get it perfect on. And that after adjustment ability is something I've just come to depend on.
Before you start drilling holes, right, you know, make sure you've got a tilting mount. Make sure you've got a 120-volt socket nearby.
Yep.
Make sure you have someplace, you know, you're either going to have to do wireless HDMI streaming with a wireless HDMI adapter, or you have to have someplace to put your, you know, your Roku, your Apple TV, your Blu-ray player, whatever you're going to attach to that television.
Some of the new TVs, especially all the new like, I want to say the MU8000, 9000, and all the QLED TVs from Samsung incorporate very thin cables that go to the back of the TV with an external input box. And that might be something else that can at least get you from having to run HDMI in the wall if you really want to hide it well. Ideally, you're going to have a power outlet behind the TV in addition to some kind of conduit to get the HDMI cable, at least one single run to the TV itself. That generally is low voltage. You can actually get in wall-rated cables and things like that. I mentioned wood frame construction. Metal frame construction is not much more difficult. With either case, you just want to make sure you're hitting the center of that stud when you're drilling through it. Get as good of a bite as possible. Don't over-tighten your fasteners. And it's a great way to protect your investment and to keep, you know, tip over accidents and other things. I know a lot of parents who are just wall mounting TVs for the safety.
Yes.
Alone.
Having seen my son basically try to do a chin up on a mounted TV.
Oh Lordy.
It's always good to overbuild.
Yes. Yes. Hang a little body weight on that mount and make sure it's really on there good before you, and that's the other thing too. Like 42 inch and even some 55 inch screens I've looked at, they weigh like 20 pounds. They're very lightweight. I'm not going to suggest you hang this on drywall, but you could with the proper fasteners. And if you have any question about how to find a stud or things like that, there are some amazing YouTube videos out there that go through, you know, even specifically what are the best fasteners to use and things like that if you're not going to use the included stuff. But that's one anybody can do.
Oh, my goodness. Got a wonderful tweet from at PKAVFC. Starship Troopers 20th Anniversary Edition 4K UHD Blu-ray Steelbook. Best Buy exclusive, $25. So
I have to have that.
I understand.
It's going in the list of things to buy this week.
You know, if you buy the 4K UHD Blu-ray, well, it's funny because I guess you can buy. It looks like you can buy the Blu-ray currently from Starship Troopers, that the title actually goes on sale September 19th, 2017 for the 20th anniversary.
Oh, Best Buy exclusive.
Best Buy exclusive. For the Steelbook. Yeah. If you want this cool steel container, you can get it off Amazon September 19th for $25. I have not seen any reviews yet of the transfer.
I love the very fascist-looking cover of the Steelbook edition.
It is particularly fascist.
It's a fascist movie. It's one of the beauties of it. Paul Verhoeven was a genius.
Paul Verhoeven.
Mixing 90210 and the most ultimate. Oh, no. So, that's going to be a sad day.
Well, you said he was a genius.
Oh, no. He is. And he was a genius with that movie in particular.
I was a little confused about that.
I'm also thinking in past tense of after listening to like DVD commentary. I have listened to that commentary. He better be around.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's
But that's going on my short list.
It's an amazing movie. It's not. Goodness, it's an amazing movie.
It is. There's something for everyone in that one.
And if not, well, We're sorry, but we love it. We're just not going to apologize about that. It's an odd translation of a Robert Heinlein movie. I'll be very curious to see
the novel. I must, you know, that's a book I haven't read. Actually, I wouldn't mind.
You haven't read that?
No, Starship Troopers.
Copy.
Rico.
It's a little different in the book.
Maybe.
With that, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my goodness. At AVXL is the place to tweet to us. Ask at AVXL.com is a great place to send us questions. If you'd like to help support the
show,
we'd appreciate that. And you can join us at patreon.com/AVXL. We got a hangout coming up on Saturday.
Cool.
Saturday.
We are due.
And we'll put a link on that in the show notes.
Personalized.
Actually, it should probably be next
AVXL
Saturday.
Service.
Give everybody a warning. Not this Saturday, but next Saturday.
Yeah. Come on.
Math is hard.
Come one, come all.
Or you can do it Sunday. Anyway, patreon.com/AVXL will have the link to the Hangouts. And we want to thank each and every one of you for listening. AVXL.com is the place to get all the information in the show notes that we mentioned and how to subscribe. And hey, thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.